Welcome to Vox Talks Economics, recorded live at the PSE CEPR Policy Forum 2025. My name is Tim Phillips. In this episode, what happens when working from home changes where we want to live? Now that many of us work part or all of our week at home, does that mean we want to move to a different area or a larger house? And what is the effect on housing for those who cannot work from home? Morgan Richard of Stanford has researched how Londoners sought out new homes post-COVID to match their flexible work patterns and estimated the impact of their new working lives on house prices and rents for everyone living in the city. Morgan, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Most of the research that I have seen on working from home is about the working bit. You are instead focusing on where people live. Why is it important to think about that?
Because what work from home does is that it loosens the link between where people live and where people work. I really think about this very important big decision that the households make. That is, where to settle, where to buy, or where to rent. And this decision parameters have really changed since the rise in work from home. So it's, I think, quite important to look at it now in this new context, and this will have massive implication for the households themselves.
How has working from home changed our choices around where we live, and who gets to make those choices?
It has quite changed our choices, because if you only have to get into the office, let's say twice a week instead of every day, it really decreases your commuting cost. So if you think about what area is livable around your workplace, this really increased. And so that means that you're way more flexible to make some choices. So for instance, if you want more space, you can move further out, that is usually cheaper, and get that more space. Or if you're interested in some particular amenities that are located in a special place, like if you're a climber and live in Paris, you would want to move next to Fontainebleau, for instance. Now with remote work, you can do it. So there's a lot more freedom and potentially wealth gains. Now there is one catch, there is one condition. So you need to be able to remote work. And this is very much the case for some occupations, like economists, for instance, and very much not the case for other occupation, truck drivers. And in this particular case, I'm working on London, so I will use the Office for National Statistics data. And they say that between September 2022 and January 2023, 44% of the workforce were working from home, a bit less than half the workforce population. And it's not just a random half. The research shows that the workers that are able to work from home tend to belong to the higher educated, higher skilled and higher wage part of the population. So it's really an asymmetric shock.
This can't be the first time that something like this has happened, is it? That has meant that people change where they live in a city because of some technology or social change?
Absolutely. If we look at what does work from home do, it like decreases the attractivity of the center and brings it towards the suburb. This particular movement has occurred, for instance, if you think about the time where the underground network was developed or even the highway constructed. So we've seen technological changes doing this before. Some other changes, like potentially society changes, could do the opposite. The increase in female labor force participation meant that it delayed the age of the first child. And there's a beautiful paper by researchers in Sciences Po and Mannheim that showed that younger couples then stayed in the center longer. So it has the opposite effect. Now, there is one thing that is unique about remote work. It's really tailored to part of the population that was already privileged. And so this very asymmetry in the nature of the shock, I think, is quite unique. And I wanted to explore this.
And that does imply that what comes out of this will be some winners and some losers.
It does. It was not obvious that this would be the case, because when you think of the nature of this shock, what is it? You have some innovation in the way we organize labor, some extra flexibility given to some people. And potentially you could say these are the winners, but the other part of the workforce, they didn't get anything taken away from them. So potentially they could just be indifferent. Now, where the trick is, what's happening is that everybody is competing for some scarce resources, land and housing. And so when the housing demand of the telecommuters increases and shifts geographically, the prices do follow. And then this will trickle down to the non-remote workers who will end up being losers. So at the end of the day, the housing market acts as a bridge that channels the impact of work from home from the remote workers to the non-remote workers.
And if we're going to measure who are the winners and losers, on what scale do we measure that?
So this is really hard to measure. We can measure in the data who can remote work and who cannot. But this is why I will need to build a structural model to reproduce this rise in remote work, how the demand for house prices and rents and where in the city has changed, model how the price respond, and then compute the welfare implication for everybody.
We are increasingly aware of how economic conditions filtered through the housing market create winners and losers. In April 2024, we spoke to Rui Mano from the IMF's research department about how rising rates filtered through mortgages were hitting some borrowers and some countries harder than others. Follow us to listen to our episode, Monetary Policy, Mortgages and the Housing Market.
So you did this for London. Now, for people who don't know London, have never lived in London, can you describe where it is that people live and where they work in London and whether they rent or own houses, what the commuting experience in London could be like?
Well, first of all, for people who don't know London, I'll say, come visit. It's glorious. More seriously, my paper is about the London travel to work area,
yeah,
which is the 32 boroughs of Greater London, but a little bit beyond. So in the areas that are well connected.
Uh-huh.
The idea is that it's a statistical unit that encompasses an integrated labour market. People live and work there. So from that point, well, you can think about the centre as being more or less zone one and two of the London Underground. So it's 20% of the overall superficie. And you can think of places like Camden or Westminster to be in the center. And then the suburb from zone two all the way towards the end of the travel to work area, which is 80% of the surface. And you can find places like Greenwich. Hear about where people live in my microdata. 40% of the population lives in the center in 2019,
mm-hmm.
but 60% of the jobs are in the center. So there's a bit more density in the jobs in the center. About the homeownership, in London, 49% of the Londoners owned their home in 2019.
Right.
Which is quite low if we compare to the national average
of 64%.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. And it's because house prices in London are extremely high.
Mm-hmm.
And about the commuting, so London has a really nice public transportation network by the TfL, Transport for London. Roughly a third of the Londoners go to work with the public transportation, a third take their car, and a third walking or cycling. And in terms of like average commute time, I use TfL data for tube journeys. And in the center, the average one-way commute is 34 minutes. And in the suburb, 64 minutes one-way.
You were living in London at this time. Where did you live?
I was living in Bow.
Bow. So you were in the East End, traveling to UCL in
exactly.
The center.
Traveling to the center, 40 minutes one-way.
Okay, so you are tracking house and apartment prices and rents. And you do this before COVID and after COVID. So where do you get that data? Is that Office National Statistics data?
No. So the data comes from what I needed is my data to have a very detailed mapping between the price and the characteristics of the houses.
Mm.
And so for this, I had to merge three different data sets. The first one, it's publicly available. It's wonderful. It's His Majesty Land Registry Price Pay Data, which is the universe of all the properties transacted in the UK since 1995. From this, you have the prices, the location of the property, so the address, and some very scarce, I wouldn't say bad, characteristic about the houses. For rents, I got preparatory data from the CDRC, and it's the Zoopla dataset, so all the properties listed to rent on the Zoopla website since 2014 in England and Wales. And once again, I have the rents, the address, but some scarce characteristics. So to know more about the properties, I'm using some regulatory framework from the UK. In the UK, for a house to be sold or let, it needs to have a valid EPC certificate. And that's an inspector coming to your house and logging a bunch of detail about your property. The size, number of room, if it has double glazing, if it's a new build, whatnot. But then because it's regulatory, there is the universe of all properties. And that's publicly available. So I could match at the address level to get the mapping between prices and characteristics.
If you're looking at the mapping between prices and characteristics, then the characteristic we're interested in is how far people travel to get to work. What can it tell you about that penalty of having to live far out from the centre so you can afford to buy somewhere or rent somewhere and come to work where the jobs are?
Exactly. So the approach that I take, because I have such detailed characteristic, is what we call hedonic pricing schedule. It's the idea that a house is made of different components. So one is the size, one is the distance. It could also be, do you have a garden, the type of building, and whatnot. And the price of the house is taken as the sum of the price of these components.
Right.
So by this, I can look at the price of distance, which is negative, as you say. Properties located further out are cheaper, so that's penalty for distance. And I look at how it evolved over time. And I do find that this has decreased since the rise of remote work. So for instance, the average distance penalty of the average house in the suburb compared to the center has decreased by 7.5% since February 2020.
I see. Right. That's quite a big difference, isn't it? Now, why is it important to capture this in general equilibrium? You might have to explain what general equilibrium really means.
Well, as I told you earlier when we were talking about winners and losers,
yes,
what we have is one part of the workforce gets given this extra flexibility and opportunity. And potentially we have winners, we don't have any losers. But now what is going to happen is that this part of the workforce who's changing their housing demand, we will have equilibrium prices getting into action, meaning price will respond.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we didn't have general equilibrium, just means that we will allow prices to respond in each of the city location. And so if we didn't have this response of the prices, just the part of the workforce who cannot remote work would just not be impacted. It is only through this general equilibrium effect that we do see how the welfare moves throughout the entire population. So this is key.
So all the people who cannot change where they are living, they might have to pay more rent, for example. So how do you do this? I imagine it's a lot more complicated than just doing this on one sort of route into town between one suburb and one destination.
Absolutely. There are 1,000 routes and 1,000 of locations in London, and it's very
yes.
granular. I do have to make some simplifications. So I do have to build a structural model that is a simplification, no matter how complex it is, how many detailed and hypotheses you're making, that is a simplification of the real world. Now, the idea is to really be on a trade-off between having all the details and the complexity you need to get at your mechanism of interest, but keeping it simple enough so that A, you can solve it,
mm-hmm.
and B, you can still learn from the mechanisms. So this is what I'm doing. I'm simplifying the city between two locations, a center, zone one and two, and a suburb beyond zone two, and really taking into great care of modeling the household choices in terms of where they live, if they buy, and the work choices. And by this, I get at my important mechanism, the change in housing demand, in total, but also across location. And I do need that to get at it. But then I could be a lot more detailed and having 1,000 locations, but I just wouldn't be able to solve it. And I wouldn't need it.
Now, I remember the newspaper stories from COVID talking about how there's going to be huge demand for housing in the suburbs as people move out of the centre and nobody will be left in the centre. What does your model tell us about what happened to demand for housing?
So demand for housing has changed. That is absolutely true. The mechanism is simple, really. The workers employed in occupations where work from home is feasible, they'll spend a higher share of their total work time from home. So what they need is basically more space. They might need an office space, some place to put their desk chair. And, well, this will increase the demand for space. And they will commute to the office less often, only twice a week instead of every day, let's say. So that decreases the distance to commuting penalty.
Mm-hmm.
So we have higher demand for space, but lower commuting penalty.
And how does this translate into house prices?
It obviously does.
Yes.
So in the model, we do see that house prices and rent increase everywhere across the city, but more so in the suburb. So the increase everywhere relates to this increase in the demand for space.
Uh-huh.
And this higher increase in the suburb relates to the lowering of this distance penalty. Now in the model, I get to an increase of 5% in the suburb after 2 years,
right.
and 2% in the center. And that's quite interesting because if we compare it to the data, in the model, my only driving force is this change in work from home. It already accounts for 3/4 of the observed rise in the prices in each location in the data, and also this decreasing in the distance penalty. So work from home is key to drive housing demand.
Gosh, is this what you are labeling the telepremium?
Yes, exactly. So what I'm labeling the telepremium is this extra benefit
mm-hmm.
for the workers employed in occupations where work from home is feasible. So for the workers who can remote work, because they want more space and they commute less, they can move out to buy larger properties, right? That's what they're actually doing. So in the long run, over 75 years, that's what I mean by the long run in the paper,
mm-hmm.
their homeownership rate increases by 50%.
Wow.
This is, yeah, quite huge. But there is the reverse of the coin, right? Because the suburb is where the cheapest properties used to be located. So the marginal owner will now be crowded out of homeownership.
Hmm.
The marginal owner will not have access to homeownership anymore. They can't buy in the suburb anymore because now the price has hiked up. So for the workers who cannot work from home, their homeownership rate actually decreases by 15% in the same time horizon.
Gosh.
Mostly in the suburb. And it's not only about this extensive margin of owning or not, but also about the intensive margin. The non-telecommuters' average house size in the long run decreases by 10%. So we have this increased inequality across occupations.
Yes, these are quite dramatic effects over the long run. They really are changing the city. How do you interpret this? How could we interpret this as a welfare effect? Because if we're doing general equilibrium, then you can interpret the welfare effect,
can't
you?
Absolutely. I use the model to do that.
Yeah.
So the idea is to use the model to compute what we call consumption equivalent variations. So it is how much extra consumption in every period should you be given for you to be indifferent towards the rise in remote work.
Gosh, yes.
And so this is what I'm doing for the non-remote workers. And I find that every period, for them to be indifferent, they should receive 0.5% consumption more. And this sounds small, but this is quite actually large given the literature. So they do experience substantial welfare losses. And the largest losses, of course, are incurred by the renters, because higher rents decrease resources for consumption and saving. And higher house prices anyway make accessing homeownership harder.
Okay, well, we can't really stop people from moving house or prevent them from buying houses if they have the money to do it. But should policy be giving more attention to this impact of working from home on inequality, on welfare?
I definitely think that it should. Well, just because of the very nature of this shock, right? It mm-hmm. is giving some extra, well, new technology of labor organization, but still, and new flexibility to an already privileged part of the workforce. So I think there is a space for policy to at least mitigate some of these inequality enhancing aspects. It is about housing, making sure that we have higher housing affordability and playing with housing supply elasticity, which is extremely low in the UK. So I think this is a crucial area for policy intervention for sure.
Now, 100 years ago, then Londoners all had a dream of moving to the suburbs because that was considered to be the great place to live. That's what you aspired to, getting out of the dirty centre of town. Well, the centre of town in London isn't so bad anymore. And one thing that is in the centre of town now is a lot of empty office buildings.
Yes.
Now, there is that policy that's endlessly discussed, is can we make these into apartments and sell them to young professionals or people who are lower paid workers? Can you model the impact of doing that?
This is a policy experiment that I do. In the center now, we have a real estate mismatch.
Mm-hmm.
Too few residential properties, too many offices or commercial-oriented office spaces. And transforming them is quite costly. Why is it? Well, for two reasons. One is quite structural. These buildings are very different. Offices have big spaces, little windows. So that's costly, sure. But there is another aspect in the UK that is regulatory. There is a lot of regulations preventing these conversions. Some regulation may sound a bit red tapey. So for instance, I think the building needs to have been of class E for 4 years or fully empty for 3 months. So this we could alleviate a bit. And I play in the model with some reduced form way to alleviate this red tape, increasing the amount of residential housing permits in the center by 5%. What we would get is house prices and rents would decrease everywhere in the city, but more so in the center. We would have higher reallocation of the workers who can't remote work to the center and then shortening their commute. But importantly, these households would be much more able to buy houses. So the homeownership rate of the non-remote workers would increase. At the end of the day, if we recomputed the welfare, we would go from welfare losses on average for the non-telecommuters towards welfare gain with this policy. So there's hope.
It is a good incentive to remove red tape, isn't it? Now, these sort of changes, as we've discussed, have happened before and they will happen again. Is the sort of model that you're using here, is it mostly about working from home? Is it really tuned for working from home, or can it be applied to other technology changes or social changes?
No, it could absolutely be applied to other settings. What this laboratory is good for is studying when you had, one, a change in housing demand, and two, when this housing demand change was not uniformly distributed amongst locations. So another example that can pop up in mind when you think about ways to use it would be when we created the European Union back in time,
mm-hmm.
we had, so for instance, in Spain or in Portugal, quite a lot of inflow of EU nationals who wanted to buy second homes in touristy places in Barcelona or in touristy places of Spain. This had quite a big impact on house prices and quite differential across a different location. So we could definitely recalibrate the model, tune it a little bit, and look at the welfare implication for the local residents after that.
Well, Morgan, when you come back to live in London, you'll know where to get a good deal. Thank you for talking to me about this today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been really a blast.
The paper is called The Spatial and Distributive Implications of Working from Home, a General Equilibrium Model. Author, of course, Morgan Richard.
Vox Talks Economics is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zagarian. Next time on Vox Talks Economics, we're taking a break from our Paris season to introduce a new CEPR book on the state of globalization.